This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll talk with John McGinnis of LawPolitics.com, the man who's written books about Louisiana governors, primarily Edwin Washington Edwards, who now is following the trail of Governor Bobby Jindal. The latest poll numbers show once again that Governor Jindal is less popular than he was a few years ago. We'll talk with John McGinnis about this, and does it really matter since Bobby Jindal is a lame duck? The poll also shows that David Vitter, the junior U.S. Senator, is a clear favorite in the race for governor, now less than 20 months away from the finish line. And we'll talk with John McGinnis about the prospects of David Vitter in 2015 and of Mary Landrieu this year. Also, Laurie Hall Sanderson, an American writer best known for children's and young adult novels. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Your numbers, 297-5633 locally. Outside the area, it is 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org. If you'd like to reach us online, Frank Barnett producing. And our guest to spend much of the hour with us is John McGinnis, the fabled Louisiana political follower. LawPolitics.com is where you find his work. And John McGinnis is been following governors for about four decades. Two books that are well known, Cross to Bear, about the 1991 campaign involving Edwin Edwards and Buddy Romer and David Duke, and The Last Hayride, 1983 election between Edwin Washington Edwards and David Connor Treen. And now we approach 2015 with Bobby Jindal not allowed to run for a third term. He's gearing up to run for President of the United States. And U.S. Senator David Vitter, the junior senator, is ready to seek the governorship of Louisiana. We'll talk about that. But first, there are some items involving Governor Jindal that are in the news, including a shakeup in his inner circle. What's going on, John McGinnis?
Hey, good morning, Jim. How are you? Fine. Yes, it looks like Paul Rainwater, his chief of staff, will be resigning on March 3rd. LawPolitics.com broke that story. We had it up on our website yesterday afternoon. I guess it's natural that this time in a second term, back end of a governor's second term for some key members of his staff, and we start looking around for seeing what their future is going to be because they know they're not going to be with the next governor. And so for Paul Rainwater, probably a chance. He's been in public service pretty much all his life. Starting with being in the military, and he worked in local government in Lake Charles. He worked for Senator Landrieu. He worked for Governor Blanco. And he was one of the few holdovers when Governor Jindal came in, and he started out as head of the Louisiana Recovery Authority and moved up to commissioner of administration. And then when Stephen Wagasback left as chief of staff, he stepped into that position. And he's, by all accounts, he's been an honest broker and served the governor well, particularly a governor who didn't have his own good relationships with legislators. Rainwater was able to diffuse some of that, some of that friction, and always dealt with legislators straight up from everything I heard. And so, I suspect he'll be doing some kind of governmental consulting work on the private side. It'd be an opportunity for him to make some money, which so often our elected officials choose to do at some point in their career.
Who knows? He might even run for office.
Well, I guess that's possible, but his life as a staffer and like that, I suspect he'll be keeping to the business side for now on.
Okay. And the communications director, Kyle Plotkins, moving over to become the chief of staff.
Yes, he is. Another a member of the Jindal inner circle that has served him well. He came on as, as deputy press secretary and has just steadily moved up and has taken more responsibilities and is very trusted by the governor and trusted by the media. He's always dealt with us very straight up, and he's been considered also an honest broker as far as getting the news out and with information, but always taking care of the governor's interests. So I suspect Kyle might not. I have no evidence to point to this, but I suspect Kyle will be with the governor to the end of his administration.
Who knows? He might be White House press secretary someday. Why do you laugh?
Well, maybe because it's kind of funny.
Well, stranger things have happened. Remember all the people that Clinton took with him from Arkansas, and Carter took with him from Georgia, and Reagan took with him from California?
Not the humor is not in who General might take with him, but where he might be going.
Mm-hmm.
So, I was talking to Charlie Cook, another renowned Louisiana expat who is going on to be maybe one of the foremost political commentators with his newsletter, and he said outside Louisiana, you just don't, there's just no serious talk about Jindal being a serious contender. But at the same time, we saw a lot of front runners in 2012, come and go within the space of a week. Mm-hmm. We've seen already the guy like the New Jersey governor Chris Christie was the putative front runner. 4 years out, 3 years out, and he's all but gone up in smoke. I wouldn't say he's not a contender by any means, but he's not the behemoth, figuratively, that he was considered to be before his whole Bridgegate scandal started. So what I'm saying is these guys, there's a short half-life for presidential front-runners, and there's always the possibility that the guy who keeps his head down and his nose clean and doesn't make any mistakes is going may still have be in the down there in the final cut, and as far as I don't think he's a strong presidential contender, given that there is a lot more talent out there right now compared to 2012 on the Republican side. There's a lot more serious contenders of guys with government service that always show up well ahead of Bobby Jindal in any polls and contests like that. So, but if he's out there in the end and maybe competes in the primaries or even doesn't, I think he's still a viable vice presidential contender, a running mate. I think he would make a suitable running mate for a lot of presidential candidates. So, who's to say? Who's to know? I suspect, though, that Jindal is going to be a player on the national scene. He already is right now, and I think he'll just continue to do so, whether he's a candidate or just a leading Republican, or if with his new nonprofit America Next, if he's just out there working on solutions to America's problems. He's going to be having a voice in national affairs for years to come, I see.
He's only 42 years old.
Sure.
So he's got a long time. 297-5633 for John McGinnis. Mark downtown writes, given Jindal's popularity ratings or lack thereof, could Paul Rainwater's departure be a case, Mark writes, of the rat deserting the sinking ship?
I don't see it as that. A lot of second term governors get to be pretty unpopular. Jindal may have surpassed that, but no, I suspect it's less to do with Jindal and more to do with Paul Rainwater and what he sees as his future.
And there is a poll that was released yesterday, this one conducted by Public Policy Polling of North Carolina, generally a Democratic polling firm. Who commissioned this poll? Do you know, John?
I don't know for sure, but I think this PPP does these polls on their own. It's my understanding. They do a lot of polls. So,
well, the poll is very good news for David Vitter and bad news for Governor Jindal.
Yeah.
It shows the numbers that Bernie Pinson has been criticized mightily for.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like Bernie's got the right numbers.
No, I think Bernie's always had the right numbers. He's a very good pollster. It shows a general dissatisfaction with the governor, but I think there's a couple of factors in there. One is that in this second term, Governor Jindal has taken on some very controversial issues that were guaranteed to make him unpopular with a lot of people. And it's just he's not running for something in the state of Louisiana, so he's not, I guess, worry that much about what his poll numbers in Louisiana are. And in the long run, that enables one to get things done. In the long run, it may work very much to his benefit as far as popularity is concerned. But, I think he's right in what he says right now. I don't care about polls. He doesn't have much reason to care about polls in Louisiana right now. But I suspect that before he's done, he probably will improve his standing some if he stays in state a little more in the next year and keeps working on some of the things he's working on. He's going to have probably a lot less controversial agenda at the legislature this year. His key deal is workforce development. Who's going to argue with that? So I'm not surprised that his popularity has sank some. It did the same for Mike Foster, maybe not to that degree.
Not like this, no.
Not like that in his second term. But
this is more like what happened to Edwin Edwards back in 86, 87.
In each case, Edwin Edwards still had a base that stayed with him, and Bobby Jindal does too. He still has a strong base of support. But he's lost probably that middle of the road people who were with him in the past are not with him now. But polls are polls, and if you're not in the middle of a campaign, they only mean so much.
Well, Governor Jindal's response was, "I don't care about polls."
Yeah, well, I mean, I think he qualified that. He should say, "I don't care about Louisiana polls." he probably is a little more sensitive toward how people outside the state view him. But that's what he said.
Well, but if he runs for president, and he will, he's going to tout what Cal Thomas refers to as the Louisiana miracle that Governor Jindal has orchestrated, according to Mr. Thomas. So if it's a Louisiana miracle, why aren't the people enamored with the governor?
Well, there's a different view of things from outside the state when you just look at the real big picture and you work on, the images of what people think Louisiana is. They may think of Louisiana as a swamp-infested place where all the politicians are crooked, and that Bobby Jindal is a change from that. So, things are seen a little differently outside the state. Now, I'm sure there'll be, if Jindal becomes, a serious contender, there'll be a lot more closer inspection of his record in Louisiana.
And many other things. He'll have to talk about a lot of things, and some of them may be old and not worth discussing as far as the future of our country, but my guess is he'll have to talk about things like exorcism and all kinds of peripheral issues.
A lot of parents will think if children getting into exorcism is a lot better than a lot of things they can get into in college.
Well, he was not a child. He was a student at Brown University.
He was a student
Brown
in
University.
College. I'm saying people in college sure act like children a lot of times, and being very passionate about your faith it may be seen as coming wild-eyed and crazy, but it's an indiscretion of youth. But I don't figure that's going to count for much down the road. But you're right. It'll sure be talked about.
But when he was at Brown University and by his own writing witnessed and, I guess, participated in an exorcism, he also, at that time, declined to vote in the 1991 race between Edwin Edwards and David Duke. Mm-hmm. He could have voted absentee, of course, but he did not. Mm-hmm. And some would say that if he truly was a young man on the move with an eye toward the presidency, he would have voted in that election and not participated in an exorcism.
Well, then maybe he wasn't a young man with his eye on the president.
He may not have been.
Time. Maybe he was just a college student who was living his life like college students do, which I suspect was the case.
But that changed pretty quickly. At 24, he became Governor Foster's health and hospital secretary, and by the time Governor Jindal was 32 years old, he was in the race for governor of Louisiana and almost beat Kathleen Blanco. He got 48% in that race, moved up to 54 4 years later, and 66% in 2011. But what has happened? We'll talk more with John McGinnis after this 90-second timeout on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number, 877-217-5757. Outside the area, John McGinnis of LaPolitics.com is our guest, and we're talking politics before we get back to Louisiana, where there's a governor's election next year. In Texas, there is a governor's election right now, coming soon, and the Republican candidate is a gentleman named Greg Abbott, the Texas Attorney General. He's the favorite. He's been out on the campaign trail with Ted Nugent, the aging rocker, who has made inflammatory comments through the years, including calling the President of the United States a communist-nurtured subhuman mongrel. They're making our politics look pretty tame.
Yeah, that's pretty colorful, huh?
Also, Mr. Nugent has said that I'd like to shoot them dead, referring to illegal immigrants. He's referred to Hillary Clinton and other female Democrats with graphic slurs, and yet he is on the campaign trail as a presumed asset to the Republican candidate, Greg Abbott.
Yeah. Makes Doug Dynasty sound like, pretty tame stuff, huh?
Well, and it also makes this stuff with David Vitter sound pretty tame. So Senator Vitter has, as far as we know, he's been faithful to his lovely wife, Wendy, the last 7 years, and he is the favorite in the race for governor. Here, this Democratic polling firm has governor, or I'm already calling him governors. How about that? Senator Vitter, a mile ahead of the Democrat, John Bel Edwards, and every other candidate in the race. So what do you make of this?
Yeah, a bit closer with Mitch Landrieu. He was a little closer in a race matchup. And, it shows that Vitter has a strong base among Republicans. And, although there is a sizable element of voters who don't like Vitter at all, that more of the middle-of-the-road voters are a little more open to him. I wouldn't say he's sold them completely yet, but he is the strongest candidate in the race so far. But, the campaign is yet to really begin, and there's still Lieutenant Governor Jay Darden still figures into this strongly, particularly if the Democrats don't really field if they don't perform well and like they have in the last two elections. If it ends up being two Republicans in a runoff, David Vitter and Jay Darden, all bets are off then. Then the Democrats would decide, and it may be a real problem for Vitter, given that a lot of Democrats might rather go with a more moderate Republican like Jay Darden. So that's the magic of the Louisiana open primary. It opens up to all kind of possibilities. But certainly for right now, David Vitter is the strongest candidate in the field.
You mentioned that Governor Edwards always had a base of support. He never got below 28% in an election, and that was in a primary, and that was his low showing. And Governor Jindal obviously has a base. Who composes the base for David Vitter?
It's the Bernie Pinsonet in his last poll showed Vitter had the support of 50% of people who describe themselves as Republicans. So Vitter is the further you get to the right, the stronger he is. He's the kind of politician who is popular with the right wing of the Republican Party, but who can move further toward the center than a lot of politicians who are real popular with the right wing of the Republican Party. He's seen as someone who's competent and can get things done, and he also comes from the real geographically. He comes from Jefferson Parish, East Bank of Jefferson Parish, which is really the ground zero for the Republican Party. I consider their strongest area. So he has both of those things going for him ideologically and geographically.
And a super PAC supporting Senator Vitter's gubernatorial bid has asked a federal judge to declare the state's limits on campaign contributions unconstitutional. That argument was made by the Fund for Louisiana's Future. It claims that the state violates the First Amendment clause of the U.S. Constitution by capping individual contributions to political action committees at $100,000 per four-year election cycle. It appears the senator has some high rollers who are ready to pony up.
Yeah, I would find that distressing if we, because I'm no fan of the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court that opened the door toward these unlimited contributions by corporations and individuals. But I would, it's one thing on a federal level. I would hate to see it even more become a picture on a state level where you could, one candidate could attract high rollers who were, like you say, who were ready to put up $200,000 each. I remember back when I was starting out in my first book, The Last Hayride, it was not a scandal at the time, but a real eye-opener when Lou Russell Jr. gave Evan Edwards $100,000. I was like, whoa, that was, and people were really shocked. That was before there were, before Buddy Romer came in and instilled campaign financial reform and donor limits. But here we are 30 years later talking about being back at the same idea again.
As we've been speaking, an email came across, and I suspect this has been sent to several people on David Vitter's mailing list. He says, in your opinion, what is the top issue I should focus on if elected governor of Louisiana? And the list that the senator has, coastal restoration and hurricane protection, higher education, highways and infrastructure, job creation, K-12 education, political reform, spending reform and budget stabilization, tax reform, and any other topic important to you. He's kind of covering it all there.
If you concentrate on those things, not many people would argue with that. Of course, it's the position you take on each one of those issues, but those are all important ones for the next governor to deal with.
But notice, no social issues. No, we don't have guns. We don't have anything involving religion, and we don't have anything involving gay rights or abortion.
That's on the other, I guess.
All right. But those, quite often, as you know, are the issues that Republican candidates accent. It appears that Vitter is going to try to steer away from those.
Well, he certainly sounds like he's soft-pedaling those issues. That's not unusual. But, you know, when those issues do arise, those politicians, especially Republicans, they know where they stand on it, and they're quick to take that position. But I guess one thing that he's saying by that is that he's not, that might be a possibility that he's not looking at, taking the offensive on those issues. But how much more do you need? And Louisiana has got the strongest anti-abortion laws, the strongest pro-gun laws. So the issue becomes one of defense for a conservative governor like that, holding on to what's there already.
Philip in Ponchatoula. Hi, Philip. You're on the air with John McGinnis. Good morning.
Yes, I watch Cops on television, and I see these sting operations. And I haven't got a definitive answer to the question of whether Vitter's association with the D.C. Madam prostitutes, was that a criminal act? And if so, why wasn't he prosecuted?
Well, it was not a crime. No one has ever alleged people have alleged, but there was no officials alleged. His number was found in the address book of the D.C. Madam, but that's as far as it went. No one has charged him with prostitution. There's been no evidence that he, direct evidence that he, paid her to do anything. There was no sting operation where someone tried to catch him. So there's not a whole lot for anyone, any law enforcement agency to go on as far as bringing a prosecution. And the D.C. Madam is dead. So that's a pretty cold trail there. So no, it was a press scandal. It was never something where he was caught by a law enforcement official in the act or in the transaction. And of course, there's been various other a lot of other talk about the Canal Street matter in New Orleans, but again, there's been no one has brought any charges or shown any evidence that there had been statements by one woman who said that she had an affair with him, but she's not been willing to take it any further than.
I think the statute of limitations is in place now.
But he was saying, was there ever anything done?
Senator Vitter was questioned about this. I think he had one debate, if I remember right, with Charlie Melancon. And he did debate Charlie Melancon, but only once when he ran for re-election in 2010. And he was asked by Greg Merriweather of WAFB if he had ever committed a crime, and the senator would not answer the question. He said, I don't want to talk about things that happened 10 years ago. Mm. Now, translated, I think that is almost an admission that he had committed a crime, but that he thought that it was irrelevant to the campaign, and I must say the electorate of Louisiana agreed with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you on that. And I think for a lot of, remember, we're in Louisiana, and we're a state that elected Edmund Everett's governor four times, someone who was pretty open about his extramarital activities at the time. Totally open about it, but he would joke and laugh about it. So,
right.
And everyone knew what the deal was, and he was elected four times in Louisiana, so it's hard to say that we're going to be shocked at the idea that there's a Republican who was engaged in that kind of activity, too.
Yeah. Well, Edwin Edwards, in an email that I have from a few years ago, right after he got out of prison, in a question about Senator Vitter, Edwards' response, and I'm paraphrasing, but I think I have it pretty close, he said, I can't understand why a man with passing good looks has to pay for it.
Good looks. I like that.
That is an exact quote. I kind of like that, too. But Senator Vitter, to our knowledge, is on the straight and narrow. And unless there's something new, this should not be the major issue in the campaign.
I agree.
Okay. Now, we've got
a campaign. It is a burning issue with a segment of the population, but they weren't going to vote for him anyway. So.
There you go. Yeah, and it is curious that I think if you had a Democrat with these kinds of revelations or allegations, and that Democrat was in office and was a reasonably popular favorite for governor, the Democrats would give him or her a pass. And it all comes down to what your party persuasion is, I think, on this thing.
I think President Clinton is a perfect example of that.
Although Senator Vitter was highly critical of President Clinton, called for his impeachment. Here's another irony, and we'll get off this, and I want to talk about the Senate race of this year with John McGinnis. But here's Larry Flynt, who is what Gus Weil a few weeks ago called him a real sicko. He's the one who got Bob Livingston to resign, which resulted in David Vitter becoming a congressman, succeeding Bob Livingston because of allegations that Flynt had against Livingston, and then he's the one who broke the David Vitter story. Larry Flynt, who would think that he would be the investigative journalist who would make all this happen in Louisiana?
Yeah, well, there you go. That's, of course, he was focusing on one area that he certainly had a lot of interest in, Larry Flynt.
Well, and I hope that Darren Mann will play Larry Flynt in the upcoming Gridiron Show.
And I think and Flint's point was the hypocrisy of the general hypocrisy of our society that dealing with matters of sex, and that's always been his that's been his deal since as long as he's been publishing.
Mary Landrieu and Bill Cassidy, you've written recently in La Politics that Congressman Cassidy is not beloved by a lot of Republicans who don't think he's conservative enough.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, there's a lot. For many Republicans, have a very high standard of how conservative they want their candidates to be. But election time, when it gets down to it, when there's one Republican against one Democrat, they tend to put those concerns aside and then get with the Republican. And I suspect that that's what's going to happen in this race. That it come down to the actual campaign to last month's. I see Cassidy still being the strongest Republican in this race. There are two other Republicans running, and they're going to get. They have their element of support, and they're going to, if they stay in a race, they'll get their vote. I just, at this point, I don't see either Paul Hollis or Rob Manis surpassing Bill Cassidy. And so what it would say to me is that we're looking at heading toward a runoff between Landrieu and Cassidy, and so this race will be extended and we'll have
December.
A runoff in December of this year, which could really be interesting, especially if the balance – in the U.S. Senate would be determined by the balance of power would be determined by the Louisiana election. That would really be something. It'd be great for our business.
Well, and even if it's, let's say it's close between Democrats and Republicans, 51-49 or something like
yeah.
that, there still will be an enormous amount of attention
sure.
if it's a runoff. Here's something that I think that should be considered. Congressman Cassidy, who, as we know, 10 years ago was a Democrat before he started running for office, and he supported Michael Dukakis and Mary Landrieu and many other Democrats. He's now a Republican, and he is, I think, a very conservative Republican on the record. Mm-hmm. But he is acknowledged, as you say, as somewhat of a moderate or leftist by the hard right. This may actually benefit him in a runoff because the Republicans are going to vote for him by default,
mm-hmm.
and he may end up getting some Democrats and some moderates to vote
for him.
That's
what the battle's going to be in that middle of the road, 10%. They're going to decide the election. I think what it is that the conservatives, the point they make is it's a question of enthusiasm. If they don't feel strongly about Cassidy, they may cite the elections of John McCain and Mitt Romney where neither one really energized the Republican right wing, so there wasn't that strong turnout among the conservative element as it should be. But, this is politics, folks, and there's an election going on, and if you want your team to win, you better go vote. And if you don't, that's your problem. So I think I think in the end that's going to be the attitude by far of most Republicans, but that's the case. It's a matter of who can appeal to the middle of the road, and who at the same time can energize their base to get out and vote in strong numbers.
297-5633. We'll return with John McGinnis for a few more minutes and take a call or two if you're outside the area. 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org online. Back in 90 seconds with John McGinnis. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. A few more minutes with John McGinnis of LawPolitics.com. Lynn and Melrose. Lynn, good morning. You're on the air with John McGinnis.
Yes. John, I'm really interested in whether you've heard the story that I have and what's the logic behind the fact that two very wealthy liberal fundraisers are supporting efforts to defeat Mary Landrieu. The Daily Coast about a month ago announced that, and yesterday in Huffington Post, a guy named Tom Steyer is a climate change activist who they don't like her connection with oil and gas. And I'm wondering what kind of logic would give the Republicans the majority of the Senate.
Well, that shows you the power of a one issue. People who are involved in one issue campaigns. To many Democrats, they're very upset about Mary Landrieu, her position on oil and gas, and the fact that she's going to be she is the chairman of the Energy Committee. And So they were acting on those single issues. You know, at the same time, you've got some well-known Republicans in Louisiana who've given money to Mary Landrieu. So it's because they feel it's good for their business and business in Louisiana. So it's her position on oil and gas that sets her apart from most national Democrats. As a Louisiana politician, that's pretty much what's expected.
Can she win?
Oh yeah, well of course she can win. I suspect that the polls are going to show the same thing 2 weeks, a week of the election that they're showing right now. A statistical tie between Landrieu and given you've got these other candidates, but I mean, assuming we get into a runoff and it gets down to just Landrieu versus Cassidy, which I fully expect is going to be the deal, that the polls will show just what they show right now, a dead heat, and it'll be determined by who gets out and votes.
Well,
and how that middle, how that those middle of the road voters, how they break, and really what the national environment is like. Republicans are counting on the idea that Obamacare is going to be as unpopular with the general electorate as it is within the, among the Republican Party or that hardcore. And I'm just not that sure. Even if people who may overall not like the Affordable Care Act, I don't know that that's going to be the top of the mind issue with them when they go to vote in November or December. And if that's the case, it's going to work a lot more in Senator Landrieu's favor.
Well, lastly, a few observations. People are accustomed in this state to voting for Senator Landrieu. Many have voted for her five times statewide.
Yeah.
She's won five statewide elections. She lost a race for governor, got a lot of votes in that one. Some people may have voted for her six times. Although I think once when she ran for treasurer, she was unopposed. So most...
Mm-hmm.
So she won that race in 87, she ran for governor in 95, and then Senate in 96, 02, 08, now 14. So she has people who are accustomed to voting for her, and that will be an inertia that Congressman Cassidy will have a difficult time changing. But this time around, unlike other elections, there are virtually no Democratic surrogates out there for her. There are no statewide elected officials. She can't have the president here campaigning for her unless she risks losing support. So what is she going to do as far as people stating her case on her behalf?
Yeah, well, I'm sure within the oil and gas industry she may have some help there. But it may become a time when you just have to stand on your own. When she first ran for the Senate, I remember the image of Bill Clinton and Al Gore almost having to drag her across the finish line. They came down here so much in the last week. So, of course, that's not going to be the case at all this time around. But this is not her first rodeo. This is, it's the time for Mary Landrieu to be able to win it on her own. And
well,
she's
and you,
capable of doing that.
You mentioned the surrogate that quite likely she will have campaigning for her is Bill Clinton. I would imagine if it's a close race, he's the one Democrat nationally who could help her.
Mm-hmm. He sure helped President Obama.
He did. Well, John, it's always a pleasure. Keep up the good work with LawPolitics.com. You're a much bigger journalism entity now. You've got not one, not two, but three people doing reporting.
Well, Jeremy Alford's been a great addition, and he and I as a team of he's really responsible for making LawPolitics.com into the website it is, and we see just a real bright future for it. So we're looking forward to it. Looking forward to the legislative session and sharing some office space with you down at the Capitol. We'll be roomies.
All right. Thank you, John. Take care.
All right, buddy.
Bye-bye. 297-5633 is your number, and we are joined by Laurie Hall Sanderson, a writer best known for children's and young adult novels, and she is back with a book that has received nice reviews, The Impossible Knife of Memory, from Laurie Hall Anderson, one of the most acclaimed authors of young adult literature. And this one is quite telling because in some ways it's autobiographical. Good morning, Laurie.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm doing well. This is a story that is based largely upon your own life, isn't it?
It is. When my father turned 18 years old, he left high school early because he wanted to get to World War II before the war ended, you know, in that earnest young way that so many young men have. And he got there just in time to help clean up Dachau after they opened that camp and freed those prisoners. And what my father experienced there in Dachau continues to haunt him to this day. He's almost 87 years old. After the war, like a lot of soldiers, he came home and tried to put all that behind him. But the demons and the ghosts got out of the cage. And my dad descended into alcoholism when I was a young teen. And our family went through about 10 years of real hell and torment, trying to love him, being very confused about what was going on. We didn't have the word or the expression post-traumatic stress disorder then. We just knew that my dad was really unwell. So we made it through those times. But when I watched my nephew come home from Iraq and Afghanistan and saw him trying to reintegrate into civilian society, that's when I knew that the time to tell this story had come.
The book is The Impossible Knife of Memory, centering around high school senior Haley, whose dad and decorated veteran Andy struggles to escape the demons that have tortured him since his return from deployment. Did your dad and does Andy, do they ever talk about this experience that is so riveting to them?
Oh, absolutely, especially when they're in their cups. You know, that's so many of our soldiers, because we don't know how to take care of them properly. You know, they turn to self-medication, sadly, which leads to the additional strains and horrors of alcoholism and addiction to drugs. And so after, you know, enough beer or whiskey, my dad and Andy in the book would start to tell about all the horrors, you know, trying to get rid of the visions, trying to get rid of the memories. Unintentionally, of course, what winds up happening is that then you have a generation of children and your spouse who has seen these things through your eyes, too. I guess it was helpful in that we understood what was hurting him, but we were helpless in that we didn't know how to make him feel better.
He was only 18 years old when he was sent to a town outside Munich. Was ordered to help keep order in the midst of chaos, and that town, as you stated, was called Dachau. The concentration camp there had just been opened. Your father saw some horrific things as a young man. I don't think any thinking person would not have that affect them immensely.
You know, there were good things that came out of it. When my dad came home from the war, what he saw led him into the ministry because he felt that he wanted to try to make an impact of love on the world because he had seen what hatred could do. My dad was a very gifted preacher. He's a Methodist preacher and did good work. It was during the Vietnam War. He was a college chaplain. I think one of the things that drove him over the edge was having to counsel so many of our young soldiers who came back from Vietnam to a country that didn't appreciate the sacrifice and couldn't separate, you know, the men who had to serve because of the draft from their own frustrations with that war. I think my dad, hearing and seeing what they were going through, he got submerged again in that pain. We don't really do a good job in this country living up to our responsibilities to our soldiers after they leave service. And I think my family's experience and the experience in the book is way too common.
Well, in the book, Haley Kincaine and her father, Andy, they're on the road trying to outrun memories that haunt them both. And they move back to Andy's hometown to try a normal life. And what happens?
And then things get worse, don't they? Things get complicated. Moving around often is a great way to keep yourself from focusing on what's bothering you. Let's be really clear here. Andy's a good man. He loves his kid, and he knows that he's failing her. This is a family with a lot of love and a couple of broken people who don't have any resources to get help. So Haley is not only faced with having to try to keep her dad alive, but then the more mundane responsibilities of being a senior in high school, like showing up to class and doing your homework, And then she falls in love, as if life wasn't more complicated enough already.
Mm-hmm. What does your father think of the book?
My dad has dementia now.
Okay.
Yeah, he hasn't been able to read the whole thing. He knew that I was working on it before he kind of slipped under. I've been really blessed. I've been taking care of him for about the last decade. We just had to move him to a nursing facility a few weeks ago. And being able to take care of him at the end of his life has helped laid a lot of old wounds to rest for me. So we've talked quite a bit. I'm sure one of these days I asked his permission and he gave it. I might want to write about his war experience, you know, fictionalize that somehow, and so people see what that was like at the end.
There aren't that many World War II veterans around any longer.
No, they're going one day. I don't think my dad knows anybody left from his unit. He was one of the young pups, and it's fascinating to have grown up in a time, you know, what to me as a child it seemed like World War II was so far away. Now, of course, with the perspective of adult life, I know that it just happened a few years before I was born, which is so shocking. We have to find a way to keep these memories alive.
Laurie has touched on difficult subjects in the past. Her previous work, Speak, the story of a young victim of sexual assault, is now used in classrooms across the country. It spent 7 weeks on the USA Today bestseller list. What does this do to you when you write about such difficult topics?
It's, I think my experience as a teenager, having dealt with a family that was struggling, having dealt with my own depression, sensitized me to kids who don't have a voice and who might be confused about what's going on in their lives. So, if there's a theme to all of my work, I think it's that struggle as a young person to find your voice, to speak up about what's going on in your life, and to reach for help when you need it.
Your audience is targeted as young adults, but this is obviously quite a grown-up book. It's certainly not a children's book. It's a different approach, though, I would think, when you're targeting a particular audience.
When I'm thinking about younger children, I write historical fiction for kids who are, say, in sixth and seventh grade. You know, then I'm very aware and sensitive of how old they are, what's appropriate for them. But our teenagers are sadly kind of thrown to the wolves by the time they get to high school, too many of them, and are forced to deal with very adult circumstances. So when I'm writing books for them, I'm not treating them as children. I'm treating them as young adults. What's fascinating is to see how many adult readers are now turning to young adult fiction, because I think the barriers between what teens are interested in and adults are interested in are much lower than they used to be. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole new audience out there.
I was born 13 years after World War II ended, and my father served in that war, and so naturally I have a connection to it. But today, for kids who are, let's say, 15, 16 years old, who were born in 1998, that's 50 years removed, more than 50 years removed from World War II. How do they keep the knowledge that you say is important about this time in our history?
Well, what's interesting is that it doesn't matter what the war is. It doesn't matter even what the century is. The conditions of the human heart don't change over time. The details change. But the way that people relate to each other, what makes us cry, what makes us laugh, what makes your heart beat a little bit faster when that special person walks in a room, those are timeless. And I think that's what people connect to in books.
And in this book, the father is returning from the Iraq War with deep emotional wounds. And war is in many ways consistent as far as the wounds that are opened.
One of the symbols or image systems that I tried to touch on in the book was the story of the Odyssey. Haley's reading that in her English class. And I did that because, you know, that might be our oldest story in Western culture about the pain of homecoming for returning soldiers after war. It took Odysseus 24 years, I believe, to really make it all the way home, which is a great metaphor for how long it took him to get to health. And we see in the Odyssey, we see the journey of returning vets from World War II, Vietnam, and today, how hard that reentry is. And in some ways, I think it's harder today, where our soldiers get on a plane over in Afghanistan, Iraq, and then, boom, 3 days later, they can be at the mall. I can remember my dad telling me how much he enjoyed the slow crossing of the ocean when he returned home from Germany.
The book is The Impossible Knife of Memory, from Viking Press, from Laurie Hall Sanderson, an exceptional writer and quite an exceptional story. Thank you, Laurie.
Thanks so much.
And we'll be back tomorrow. Until then, stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.